The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you all for being here. I would like to now introduce my colleague and my friend, the person with whom I started my academic career here at Washington College of Law now 10 years ago, Susan Carl. Susan is the Associate Dean for Scholarship here at the law school. And her teaching and research areas lies in the area of legal ethics and history and sociology of the legal profession, employment discrimination, labor, employment law, and torts. And in a younger life, she did live in Turkey, so she does have a Turkish connection. And she really, truly has an incredibly impressive CV with incredibly impressive scholarship record, and she's a wonderful friend, and I'm very, very happy that she agreed to do this and to moderate this panel for us. The panel's title is Secularism and the Islamic Identity. The thinking behind this panel was that it would build up on what has been discussed before in the first panel specifically, and then subsequently the issues that were raised with regards to the EU accession. I mean, some of these identity issues with regards to an Islamic identity, and can Europe have Muslims as part of its European identity? All of this will be hopefully touched upon as well here. So it's sort of like bringing it all together. And in some ways, maybe tackling some of the more difficult issues that we and the Turkey, the world, is facing today. Susan, thank you.
Well, welcome, everybody. I'm very happy to be moderating this panel. I noticed that Padideh has set things up so she doesn't ever get introduced. But there are many wonderful things we could say about Padideh as well, and her commitment to teaching and to visionary ideas about teaching and scholarship and service. It's my pleasure to introduce our panel. Professor Ahmad has already been introduced this morning, and we heard his wonderful, insightful remarks. I did have only chatted with him briefly, but have already discerned that he is an erudite in many areas, including feminist legal history, which
child of the 60s.
And is more progressive as a feminist than feminist man than many of my colleagues of who are younger and
younger.
So that was a very interesting discussion that I've already had with him. Professor Ross is a professor at our neighboring institution, George Washington University School of Law, and she is an expert on children's, families, and constitutional law, and has written and lectured widely on many aspects of law and social policy. She has a research project called Children's Religious Expression in School, a Comparative Treatment of the Veil and Other Religious Symbols in Western Democracies, which I'm sure she will bring to bear in her discussion here, and is currently working on a book entitled Pluralism, Parental Values, and Children's Rights in Public Schools. She has a very distinguished background in children's rights advocacy, holds a PhD in history and a JD from Yale University, and you can read more about her in the it would take me the entire time to discuss all of her many accomplishments. Our panelist from the School of International Service, unfortunately, and something I can greatly sympathize with, is dealing with an ill child, and so she may come and join us later in the session, but she won't be here to start. But we also have here another wonderful expert, Ms. Dao Lu, who is a columnist at the Washington Times, and she is the first Turkish columnist in the United States national media. She writes about U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkey's neighborhood, and the broader Middle East, and I'm sure we will learn much from her perspective as well. And last but not least is somebody I have known for a while, Rachel Ribouchet, but I did not know all of the things there are to say about her until I looked at her biography. She is currently teaching as an adjunct professor here at the Washington College of Law. And she is also the Women's Law and Public Policy Fellow at the National Women's Law Center. She received her JD from Harvard Law School, served as editor-in-chief of the Harvard Journal of Law and Gender, and I know her because I published something in that journal while she was editor-in-chief, or I started to work on it then. And she was a law clerk to Justice Kate O'Regan of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, and also has spent time in Ireland, where she was a George Mitchell Scholar and received an LLM there, and wrote and worked for the Ireland Human Rights Commission in drafting a Bill of Rights for the region. So she, Rachel, will be serving in the hardest role, which is after the other panelists make comments, she is going to synthesize and serve as a commentator and ask questions and draw some common themes from what other people are discussing. So I'm sure we will have a wonderful conversation, and we're hoping to leave quite a bit of time for audience questions and participation at the end.
This was just to inform you that we are going according to initials. And my name begins with A. Well, we're going to continue. I'm going to continue talking about Turkey after Atatürk. In Turkey after World War II and the restoration of multi-party politics, there was what observers described as the revival of Islam. Now, political parties had to compete for votes, began exploiting religion to further their ends. But the parties were forced to abide by a constitutional requirement that said that they had to abide by the principle of laicism. That was part of the constitution, along with the other five arrows. Thus, although there was no longer what we might describe as militant laicism, militant secularism, the attitude towards Islam became more liberal than it had been. After World War II, nationalism, which had become established in Turkey, emerged as the dominant ideology in some of the countries of the Middle East, such as Egypt, Iraq, Syria. Under Nasser's charismatic leadership, I don't know whether Professor is here. He could talk on this with personal experience. Under Nasser's charismatic leadership, he came to power in 1952 after overthrowing the monarchy. Nationalism, or Nasserite pan-Arabism, began to threaten pro-Western, that is to say, pro-US regimes in the region, like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Lebanon. In fact, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Lebanon came very close to being overthrown. This was especially true after Nasser's political victory in 1956, Suez, leading to the creation of the United Arab Republic and the union with Syria and Yemen, and then the following year, the overthrow of the monarchy in Iraq in July 1958. Washington perceived Nasserism as a threat to its interests in the region. Thus, on the 5th of January 1957, President Eisenhower enunciated his doctrine and called for U.S. intervention against communist action in the Middle East. In March 1957, Jordan was forced by nationalists to cancel its alliance with Britain and the 48 Treaty. In April, the U.S. was forced to support Jordan as political turmoil continued, and in July, British troops arrived in Amman. In September, Washington announced arms for Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, and Iraq, and said it would defend pro-Western regimes against the Syrian threat. In May 1958, Lebanon complained to the UN that Egypt was inciting anti-government riots, and the UN sent troops to the Lebanon. On the same day as the coup in Iraq, on the 14th of July 1958, King Hussein announced that he would assume leadership of the Arab Federation of Iraq and Jordan. King Hussein and Shamoun of Lebanon then sought U.S. help. Next day, Washington sent 5,000 Marines to Lebanon to defend the country's sovereignty and its independence. On the 17th of July, British paratroopers landed in Jordan at the King's request. On the 19th of July, 1958, British troops landed in Libya to protect the regime from the Nasserites. Arab nationalism seemed to be on the march. Now, you may be wondering why all this history. But responding to this growing threat of nationalism, the U.S. National Security Council issued on the 4th of November, 1958, document 5820/1, declaring that the real threat to U.S. interests in the region came from Arab nationalism and not just from communism. Islam, they said, was to be the antidote to nationalism, and if necessary, as in countries like Turkey and Indonesia, to the left or communism in general. Up to this point, Arab nationalism had been essentially secular and had succeeded in reconciling Islam and nationalism, something that I tried to explain today. Christians who said the Prophet Muhammad is an Arab and he's given us Arabic, to you Muslims he may be the Prophet, but for us he is a great Arab. That was Ba'athism in brief. With this change, 1958, in U.S. policy, Islam in the region, indeed around the world, assumed a new dimension. In order to make Islam the antidote to nationalism, Washington required a local ally to promote the Islamic agenda. No one suited this role better than Saudi Arabia, the ruler of the two holy cities now, after the overthrow of the Hashemites back in the 1920s. In 1961, the Saudis had established an Islamic University of Medina for the study and export of Wahhabi Salafi ideas. Now, let me just digress very briefly. It's true, Wahhabism was a doctrine of the Saudi tribes or of the Arab tribes in the 18th century onwards, but it was never successful in any urban area. These people, supported by the British, were able to dislodge the Hashemites from the Hejaz so that the Saudis were able to capture the two holy cities, and the Hashemites then came into the Fertile Crescent. But in 1930, when the Saudis said, we are going to establish a monarchy, their supporters, the Ikhwan, the brethren, the genuine, dedicated Wahhabis, told the Saudis, but this is contrary to Islam. Islam doesn't recognize kingdoms. And so the Saudis crushed their Wahhabi followers. And Wahhabism, if you like, remained a kind of a doctrine of the Saudis, but was dormant. Now, in 1960, it was being revived with the founding of first this university, and then a whole movement which was to be international, known as the Rabita ul Alam ul Islam, or the Union of the World of Islam, sometimes described as the World Muslim League. In the war on third world nationalism, which began in 1962 after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Washington understood that after this crisis, Moscow would not risk nuclear war on behalf of any of its clients. And so, you see, I mean, you can look at any history book, you'll see the demise of nationalism, not just in the Muslim world, but around the world. For instance, Sukarno, which is a Muslim country, was overthrown, and there was a large-scale massacre of the left, the communists. In Africa, Nkrumah was overthrown in 1966. Even in Greece, where you had a nationalist regime under Papandreou, there was the colonel's coup on the 27th of April, 1967. In Egypt, you see the beginning of the rise of this kind of Islam, but it required the Six-Day War of 1967, which led to Nasser's fall and death 3 years later. Before the war began, you find this movement becomes active in Pakistan, which was, at its birth, yes, they said a Muslim nation, but essentially a secular nation. The founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was a secular man to his fingertips. He wasn't even an Orthodox Muslim. But here you have the tragedy of the death of leadership. He died the following year. But it's only in the 60s that this movement, known as the Jamaat-e-Islami, receiving Western support against Ayub Khan, brought about the fall of Ayub Khan and later Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto. And of course, you have the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in a very new form, and very foolishly, Sadat used the Muslim Brothers against Nasserites who lived on after Nasser's death, and people warned him, he who rides the tiger is likely to be eaten up. And sure enough, in 1980, poor Sadat was shot by so-called Islamists. To come to Turkey, Turkish nationalism was not a threat to U.S. interests, but the left was. And so you had the founding of a movement in Turkey at that time, the movement to fight against communism, İslam ile mücadele derneği. And, you know, a movement grew throughout the 60s when the Sixth Fleet could not even anchor in Turkish ports. They would throw sailors into the sea. Ironically enough, even the Israeli government turned to Hamas in order to counter the power of Arafat's PLO Fatah in the occupied territories. I mean, it's later on what, what's his name? The man who's written a book called Blowback, lives in Washington. This was Blowback, you know, later on Hamas emerging as a threat to Israeli interests. During these years of the 1960s and 70s, the Saudis, through the Rabita movement, used their money to transform the very character of Islam by financing Wahhabi Islam around the world. I mean, I even have had a student in Boston, a black student, a black imam, who'd been taken to Saudi Arabia, where he learned Arabic, etc. So Rabita represented the face of political Islam, whose goal was to contain popular movements that call for social and economic change. The Islamist movement reached its peak when the Soviets intervened in Afghanistan in December 1978. That marked the launching of an international jihad. Not a jihad made locally, but an international jihad financed by the Saudis, but organized to a very large extent by Pakistan's intelligence, ISI. And they established what has now become very notorious, the madrasa system. I mean, madrasa is a school. That's where I started learning to read and write. I mean, you know, it's just another name for school, but madrasas were organized in Pakistan. There was a very interesting study written by Human Rights Watch in New York in 1996, which explained how these madrasas had become the sort of hotbeds of misogynists. I forget this lady's name who wrote that she was the head of Human Rights Watch, but she said, during the war against the Soviet Union, they gathered all the male orphans and they brought them to Pakistan. These were children who had no contact with women. Their fathers had died. They were taken away from their mothers and their sisters and their aunts, and they were brought to Pakistan and educated by these so-called mullahs, probably Pakistani or Afghani tribal mullahs. And they were told that, you know, women are temptresses and danger, etc., etc. And that's how they grew up. And this was the Taliban. When the Taliban came to power in 1996, that's why she wrote her report that year. So you have the beginnings of jihad. Revolution in Iran in 1979 launched revolutionary Islam, I put that in quotations, that was nationalist and totally hostile to being dominated by Western powers. But Iran was branded Shia Islam, although one of Khomeini's principal aims was to try and unite Sunnis and Shia. Never succeeded. And Shia Islam was seen as a threat to the Saudis and the Gulf regimes, and that made Wahhabi Islam all the more important if the Iranian challenge was to be met. And so what I argue, and what surprises me, is that somehow this November 1958 document, I mean, I read it in an American diplomatic history book, isn't widely used. I don't know why. I mean, I'm not making it up. I give you the date. In fact, if there had been time, I would have read you the whole document. But for some reason, people don't talk about it. I don't know. I'm not sure why. It must have been available by the 1990s when this textbook was written. Anyway, I think I've had my 15 minutes. Let me conclude by addressing the questions that have been asked, we've been asked to consider. What is meant by the term secular Islam? We know that secular Christianity means give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God that which is God. In theory, there cannot be a secular Islam because sovereignty belongs to God, in theory. But in practice, sovereignty in the Muslim world, right from the very beginning, was exercised by the community or by the ruler on behalf of the community. If the Ottoman Empire is to be taken as a model of an Islamic society, the Sultan acted in a thoroughly secular manner when he passed qanuns, what we talked about this morning. That is to say, secular laws outside the Sharia, but acceptable to the Sharia. And this system continued for centuries, secularized more and more in the 19th and early 20th century. The second question, is an Islamic identity consistent with secularism as understood in the Western democracies, also deserves an affirmative answer. After all, there are now millions of Muslims. In fact, I wanted to ask the panel earlier, how many million Muslims? Maybe someone can say. They're already within the European Union. Muslims of America, I just read, becoming more and more part of the system. In Britain, in fact, this book says the British ought to learn from the American model. So the majority of Muslims living in the Western world have no problems with identity. The problem, I suggest, has risen, is of recent making, and is part of what I call the infection of Wahhabi Islam. Finally, does the Islamic identity affect relations with the European Union? I don't think it does, except for a minority. Anyway, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm intrigued to find myself here for reasons that will soon become apparent. We seem to have an unusual contest going on today by speakers who claim, starting this morning, to be the most ignorant about what we're doing here today. And I can assure you, I win hands down. If some of this morning's speakers were illiterate, I am beginning to learn the first three letters of the alphabet. I'm an expert in U.S. law regarding children and families and the Constitution. I have done some comparative work on the veil, which introduced me to some of the issues concerning Muslims in Germany, where the veil, in fact, is not an issue, as I'll tell you later. I've never been to Turkey. I did read Snow in preparation for this conference. So I've really learned a lot, but I hope that I can also enlighten the discussion. I'm very glad that, and in fact, many of the themes that I identified have been touched on in the earlier panels, as you'll see. I was really glad that the last panel really brought out the elephant in the room, which is the question of whether Muslims can be accepted in Europe. Former Chancellor Kohl called Europe a Christian club in the context of discussing the prospects of Turkey's joining the Union. And subsequently, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey, when Turkey was rendered eligible to join the EU, said this confirms that Europe is not, in fact, a Christian club. But if Europe is a Christian club, it may today be largely a cultural club, as Europeans have become more and more secular in their observances and less likely to actively belong to a church or to attend church services. Nonetheless, Europe, like many societies, as sociologists and anthropologists have long shown, largely defines its identity by who is not us. Who we are is defined by who is the other, and Muslims and Turks fulfill that role. Nonetheless, the teaching of religion in public schools in Germany, where I'm going to focus in looking at the Turkish population in Germany and how Turks have or have not assimilated there, is very important. The German Constitution, while providing for separation of church and state and also for freedom of religion for individuals, provides that parents have a right to have their children educated in a religion of their choice in the schools, and in fact is understood to mandate that the schools must provide a time slot for religious training, and I will come back to that. As the speakers noted this morning, schools play a key role in our civic society and in training new generations to understand the norms of civil society. In the light of this controversy, and I apologize, I'm probably going to mispronounce this Turkish name, Sem Özdemir, who is a German of Turkish origin and who serves on the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, has said, when you talk about the debate on Turkey's EU membership, it immediately becomes a talk about headscarf issues and mosques. So Turks are the largest immigrant group in the EU, as many as about 4 million today, and about half of them live in Germany, because there are about 2 million Germans of Turkish origin, or Turkish Germans, not all of them citizens, and virtually all Turks are Muslim, 98-99%, as I understand it. When pundits say the integration of Muslims into German society is a forefront issue in our politics, they are largely referring to Turks. We have 700,000 Muslim children in German schools. Most of them are of Turkish origin. A Turkish scholar, Ayhan Kaya, notes that most of the German Turks are poor. The poorer they are, the more religiously observant they are, and the less likely they are to apply for citizenship. In fact, despite some changes made in the late 1990s to make it easier for Turks born or living in Germany to become German citizens, the rate of citizenship is just over 40%, so it's not striking. And there's some questions about why this is, but one of the great barriers had been that in order to become a German citizen, they would have had to renounce Turkish citizenship. They were not willing to do that, and that has been modified. Now, these poor and religious Turks in Germany are part of the first wave who came as labor migrants. And there was some talk in earlier panels about this question of, will all the peasants in Turkey suddenly move to Germany? No. But they have been very dominant in understanding, the peasants have been very dominant in the image that Germans have, as well as the citizens of the Netherlands, of who Turks are. They were poor, they were uneducated, more than half the women who came were illiterate, they were rural, they didn't understand a lot of things about modern life. Now, it's also interesting that in the first panel there was a lot of discussion about the importance of gender in the decision to promote a secular society under Ataturk, because these women coming now in the 1960s and early 70s were illiterate. They had never worked outside the home. And it was only in 2003, as I understand it, that Turkish law was changed so that married women could continue to be employed without their husband's express consent and also had a right to share the property of the marriage in the event of divorce. Coming back to Germany, the concerns among the Germans, as in much of Western Europe, have to do in part with the declining birth rate among the Europeans, including the Germans, and their aging population. Again, things we've noted earlier. The Turks are younger and they have much larger families. But if you look carefully at the demographics, the German-Turkish population is also gradually beginning to age. Fewer very young children of Turks born today than some time ago. But if EU membership comes and free labor market travel is available, people are very worried about what that will do to the internal populations, the representation of Turks and Muslims by inference within Germany itself. Will new generations of Turks who come as laborers with freedom of movement decide to stay and become citizens, or will they see themselves as people who have come as sojourners and who plan to return as people expected the migrant laborers would do in the 60s? Will these new waves of immigrants be assimilated? Do we want to assimilate them? Do they want to be assimilated? And so these questions have prompted a lot of controversy and also some early generation studies of what has happened to the second generation who were born in Germany and are now in the labor market, so that we can look at what happens to them. But I should also note there were two later waves of immigration, and they were very different as a collective identity in terms of their backgrounds and their success. The second wave were political asylum seekers who tended to be more secular and more well-educated. And then a third wave are people who were fleeing violence and conflict between the Kurds and the Turks in certain parts of the country. And those latter two groups have not been studied because their children aren't old enough yet. So we don't have comparisons to people who came from that background. We're really studying the peasants. And when I say we, I mean scholars generally. This is not work that I have personally done. Because the Turks in Germany have largely not sought citizenship, they have virtually no political influence. They're not going to, for example, run for the local school board. As one German commentator put it, referring to the state of Bavaria, there are 16 states in Germany and Berlin. They all make their own laws about education, so this is similar to the United States, where a lot of the law is local. But somebody said, you know, there is no risk that Bavaria, which displays crosses in the public schools, despite the fact there's no established church, there's no risk they're ever going to allow non-Christian religious symbols to be displayed side by side in the schoolroom. After 9/11, all of these issues, of course, became more more salient. They were more visible. People felt free to talk about them. It was a little bit as if somebody put a little bomb on the train track. that was described in our last setting. They're sitting in that train car because somebody interfered with the tracks, and part of that was 9/11. But that means that young people may be alienated, marginalized, and ripened for antisocial behavior of a variety of kinds, including juvenile delinquency. There are studies in Netherlands that show that very clearly, but also perhaps for religious and political martyrdom. And so key questions are, do the young people feel merely tolerated, or do they feel they are being treated with respect and as equals? And to what extent do institutionalized structures, laws, and legal norms promote either the integration of these newcomers or their exclusion, and that we need to think differently about what the law does from what individual people with biases may do. So I'm looking primarily at the legal structures and norms. So what happens to the second-generation Turks in the German schools? Some very good research by a number of groups, particularly one led by by Richard Alba. I'll try to pull this up. He confirms that the Germans track, beginning after the fourth grade. Most of the second generation Turks are in the lowest track. Very few make it to gymnasium and therefore to university. What accounts for this? Some of these things are attributable to the immigrants themselves: visibility, their looks, their language, their dress, their manners. But those are often reduced by the second generation. Some are cultural, as the culture religion or culture more generally, distance from middle class values that are highly related to success in school, or what Weber called cultural capital, values of modesty, not putting yourself forward, not being too personally ambitious, trying to be integrated into your group, very different from the striver who's trying to get into the best university. Others are imposed by society, law, and custom. In Germany, parental advocacy can be very important in what track you go into. Many of the Turkish parents do not understand the stakes. They don't advocate for their children. But equally important, when you compare similar families, German and German of Turkish origin, the Turkish children are 16% more likely to be in the lowest track. What accounts for the differences? Although it's changing a little bit, but very slowly. Large family size, immersion in their ethnic, cultural, and social world. Turkish spoken at home, head of household's best friends are also Turks with whom he speaks Turkish. Intent to return to the homeland, sending your children back to Turkey for part of schooling, and to a lesser extent, discrimination. Intriguing gender twist. In the Netherlands, some very recent data suggests that the girls are more likely to finish high school than the boys among the Turkish community, in part because of their limited marriage prospects. They're not going to marry out to Dutch men. Turkish men are sending home to Turkey for more compliant brides. And the older sisters are seen as mediators. They're out there in the arranged marriage without the education. They come back home, they say to the parents, don't do this to my younger sibling, and they help the younger sibling get more education. Now, can you bear with me for a couple of minutes? Because I do want to talk about religion in the schools as well. I'm sorry. And, of course, this tracking affects labor market prospects. And the one other very interesting finding is that increasingly the students in the higher tracked schools are also seeking apprenticeships. When they apply for apprenticeships, that means they're unavailable to those in the lowest track, who are least preferred, and therefore they leave school without either technical training, vocational training, or any sort of certificate. They are going to be manual laborers at best forever, no further along than their parents. Okay. As I said, the Constitution in Germany provides for religious training. It is contracted out to to organized religious groups, which are given a certain number of hours a week to come into the schools and give the training there. The private groups control the curriculum, choose the teachers, and run the whole religious program. The fact that the Muslim religion is not organized in a hierarchical way, like the Catholic Church or like the Protestant churches in Germany, has been deemed to pose a virtually insurmountable barrier to teaching the Islamic religion in public schools. The German government or the federations say there isn't an incorporated religious body with which we can deal and to whom we can contract this out. There is also, as has been noted, and as we all know from reading the newspapers about events in the world today, a lot of different approaches to Islam at war with each other. And so many of these groups are all claiming that they should represent the group, should do the teaching. And many of the parents are very upset because they don't want, the Islamic parents, don't want members of other sects teaching their children in the schools. So beginning in 1980, the Islamic Federation, which is affiliated with Turkey's Welfare Party, a populist Islamic movement, began to seek permission to teach in the Berlin schools. And it is a group actually monitored as a radical group by the German government. Several court rulings followed, appellate ruling in 2000 saying, deal with this federation. And everybody thought that was over, but in fact, since 2003, only 4,500 students in Berlin have actually taken classes given by the Federation. And now there are continued negotiations with an umbrella group representing six different groups that account for about 70% of Berlin's Muslims. The other states are much further behind. 2 minutes. A Berlin principal in 2005 went into one of these classes. She had been told she could not come in. One of the bargaining points was the classes be taught in Turkish or would they be taught in German? The government insisted they be taught in German so that all children would be eligible and also so they could know what was going on, but then they couldn't get a hold of the curriculum. So she came in, said the window needs fixing. And in the context of this, listened to a class, and she was outraged and went public. She said, this is an objectionable fundamentalist curriculum. They're telling the girls that they have to be housewives, take care of the children, that they have to sit meekly in class, not participate. The boys are jumping up and down. And so there was a lot of concern about that. So today, there is no place in Germany where Islam is treated the same as Christianity in the schools. There are great disparities. Many work with the local mosques, which parents think are too radical. There are also integrated issues of lack of respect. A story about a teacher teaching Kristallnacht and saying to identifying a Turkish child who said, why didn't the Jews just leave? And she said, for the same reasons your family doesn't leave. Turks find it difficult to leave if they own a shop. They would want all their possessions. You know, how will you know when it's time to leave? Now, we have the same problems in the United States with individuals, but if this is pervasive, then there are very clear messages. So the last question I'd just like to raise with is my own speculation. If Turks coming from a place where public secularism is imposed come to Germany and they say, here we're free to wear our veils to school, we're being asked to publicly identify in school, are they in some way being misled by the fictions that the law provides to think that it would be a positive thing to go public with their religion, publicly state their identity in a way that actually backfires, especially combined with the sociological data that the more closely connected they are to the Turkish community, the less well their children are likely to do in school. I'm sorry for running over.
I'm happy to say that our fourth panelist was able to come, so I'm just going to very briefly introduce her. Dr. Kadayıfçı Oryayanda is an assistant professor of peace and conflict resolution at the School of International Service here at American University. You can read more about her CV in the biography section. She has done a great deal of training in conflict resolution and mediation between Muslim and non-Muslim communities. I think I'll just, in the interest of time, leave it at that and introduce the doctor.
Thank you, and I apologize for coming in late for some emergency health issues related. Yes, as our moderator mentioned, my background is in conflict resolution, and I've been working on conflicts that involve religious identity and especially Islamic identity. I traveled recently to Iran. We took a Muslim peace delegation. I've been to Saudi Arabia, to the most conservative university that produces much of the imams that are sent around the world. And I've also worked on Islamic movements in Palestine. And our next project is on madrasas in Pakistan. And as a Muslim Turk who identifies herself as a secular Muslim, I've never thought I would actually be studying Islam. It never occurred to me when I first entered into the field of conflict resolution that I would do anything with Islam. And when I came to the United States, it just somehow, I was identified as a Muslim, and I started seeing problems or conflicts that are involving Muslim communities and the rise of an Islamic identity, Islamic resurgence, in different forms, from fundamentalism to renewalist and to reformist movements. So it has become inevitable for me to delve into this. But I've always kept a distance to issues relating to Turkey. And one of the reasons was that we're trained in conflict resolution to be aware of our own prejudices and stereotypes. And as a Muslim, secular Muslim Turk, I too had terrible stereotypes about Islam. It tells you about our psychological dissonance, the paradoxes of Turkey. And I'd like to mention this a little bit more because I think it's very significant to understand an Islamic identity and secularism in Turkey. I have, like, my whole family represents this paradox in various forms. One side of my family is very religious in the sense that my grandmother would cover her hair, her children would fast, pray five times a day, but they were strict Kemalists and hated the Islamists. Whereas the other side of my family, never covered, were very open, very liberal in many ways, but when we discovered that that grandmother of mine was a very important Naqshbandi leader. So I grew up with these paradoxes. Now I go to Turkey, especially with the rise of this new Islamic identity, Islamic movement with the new leadership in Turkey. Everybody that I talked in Turkey are very concerned, the secularists, I mean, because there is a sincere concern and fear when we look at the experiences of modernization in the Muslim world or Islamic political leadership around the world. We see only what? Oppression, conflict, abuse of human rights. And I too had these prejudices against my own religion that I identify positively with. This sincere fear and concern is in a way very dangerous, because what happens is that it divides the society into two camps, as those who identify themselves as Muslim and those who identify themselves as secular, but it becomes a conflict almost between religious and non-religious people. And there's a hardening of positions, and people started being boxed into artificial camps, and there is no dialogue. There is no mutual understanding. And there are these, at the same time you look at Turkish, even secularists, they would identify his Ottoman legacy as a different kind of Islam, a more tolerant kind of Islam than compared to Arabs. There is this, we mentioned today, this conflict between this sort of competition over Islamic discourses within the Muslim community. A colleague of mine, Hakan Yavuz, identified seven different zones of Islam, which, due to their own historical context, have evolved into very different practices of Islam. But at the same time, what is Islam? Islam is not only a religious faith. It is a culture. After September 11th, many atheist Muslims would identify themselves, atheist Turks actually, would identify themselves as, I'm an atheist, but a Muslim. So it was very interesting to see some of my friends and students were saying, yeah, I'm an atheist, but I'm a Muslim atheist, because Islam is also a culture. And for example, this is not only true for Turkey. I went to Iran, as I said, recently, and you would find this professors of law, actually, they were from an international law department, who were very secular, who were saying that I don't believe in any religion, but he would recite the Quran most beautifully. On the other hand, in Saudi Arabia, when we went to the Imam University, just to show you the paradoxes of Muslims, this is the most conservative university in the whole Muslim world. And when we were going into Al-Imam, to Saudi Arabia, even the immigration officers didn't believe that a woman would actually be invited. Therefore, I had to have our host come and intervene to say that, yes, she is really going to Al-Imam University, where we were hosted by the president of the university and deans of all the law faculty, all the faculties of the school. And in our meetings, I'm not very good at covering myself, although I try to respect. And they were saying, don't worry, you don't have to cover. Seeing how incompetent I am at that. So you see that even there, they were more relaxed. For a Muslim woman, for non-Muslim women, they're much more relaxed in general. But for a woman who identifies herself as a Muslim and teaches on conflict, because I teach here Islamic sources of conflict resolution, peace paradigms on Islam, to do that, they had to have more, like, to me it was very indicative. But also we look at the Islamic leadership or the government today, which they don't want to identify themselves Islamic so much, but we see that they're more pro-Western, they're more pro-European integration, they're more supporting liberal economy, they're more pro-human rights discourse. On the other hand, some of the groups that identify themselves as left seem to be more anti-West, anti-EU integration at the same time because of this fear, and they said this is all a facade, this is it's not genuine, this what the Muslims are doing, it's just us. They're trying to get a hold of all the system and they're trying to change it, so we have to impose laws or we have to even bring military. I had some people suggesting that. But this is a problem because what we're doing is we're judging people on the basis of what we think their true intentions are without having a concrete proof. But that shows us in a true democracy, we have to find a balance of our values without losing our integrity. Give democracy a chance. If everyone agreed with us, then there would not be no real challenge for democracy. But of course, the competition or the struggle between the Western modernists and the Islamists, as we said in the morning, go back to the Ottoman era. And but what happened is over the 200 years or so, the nature of these groups have changed dramatically and they transformed. Western modernists, I'm using that term to identify Islamic modernists, were influenced by the philosophical, epistemological traditions of the French, especially the Enlightenment movement, which was a result of the Reformation and Renaissance. And if we look at the history of Europe, how democracy and secularism, which the French call laïcité, emerged, it was as a result of terribly bloody wars and conflicts. Turkey, as I think, relatively speaking, is a little more lucky in that sense. So far, we didn't have the density or the such terrible conflicts. But what happens is that every society develops their own models and own ideas based on their own historical experiences. So the French laïcité was a result of their own unique experiences. But what happens when you try to impose these ideas on others, it becomes a problem. It doesn't work always so effectively. Like when Dr. Ahmet was talking this morning about how Kemal Atatürk, did not, from top to down, ignore religion altogether. Worked within the religious discourse, at least to a certain extent, to provide some legitimacy, to provide some context to those new reforms. Another thing that's important to note, that as the European powers excelled in different aspects of life, they brought these ideas to the other parts of the world, but not only through peaceful means, but with the experience of colonization, etc. It's interesting, Ibn Khaldun, a 14th century Muslim scholar, observed that those who are vanquished imitate the conquerors because they think that imitation will remove the causes of defeat. I think this is not the whole of story, but there is some truth in it, in that sense that many Muslim countries try to regain their historical superiority through adopting or experimenting with the Western ideas of secularism, nationalism, and democracy. But we have to understand the emergence of Islamic identity today, not only in that, but we have to take into consideration other factors like globalization, like the impact of colonialism, imperialism, Cold War conflicts, and also the failure of Soviet Union. And although we look at the modernization movements within Islam, it goes back further in the history, they were competing against different ideologies. And many of those ideologies seem to have failed over the recent years. And a lot of the disappointments of these communities also influenced. But what is also happening is that this imposition of ideas creates a sense of loss of identity. When we talk about globalization as having two dimensions, one is the economic dimension, one is the cultural dimension. New technologies have increased contact and increased the speed of that contact. And there is a sense of losing identity. In conflict resolution studies, we've coming to the realization that identity, like food and shelter, is a very basic, very important human need. And if not satisfied, it generally leads to conflict. Eventually, first, it might not be so overt, but eventually it leads to conflict. So I think it's important to understand what identity means. Okay. And I will very quickly, I don't have time to go into all of those different social psychological dimensions of identity, but one of the things that we observe is which aspect of our identity is under pressure or denied or rejected tends to become emphasized, although we have multiple identities. You can be a woman, you can be Muslim, you can be this and that. But if we feel that our Muslimness or our religious identity is oppressed, there is a tendency for people to identify with that. So defensive psychology, whether good or bad. But and religion is a very important component of our identities. For many people especially, it provides legitimacy, it provides, it answers very important questions, it provides myths and vocabulary that gives content to our identity. So when a form of secularism, which has been the secularism in Turkey has come to, at least to me, seems to be more rigid now than before. It's becoming more and more rigid, where any expression of religious identity is seen as a problem. This goes back, as I said, to the French experience and French model. But I don't think that's the only model out there, because what happens is that when you feel like you cannot express your religious identity, your thoughts on these issues, you feel oppressed. And it sort of leads to holding on to that identity strongly. But I am a secularist, as I said, and I think there are different models of secularism. For example, as I've seen secularism practiced in the US, of course, this is a big debate in the United States right now too, and we're constantly negotiating and renegotiating what secularism means in every society, which I'm not going to go in there right now. And a secularism that keeps equal distance to all religious traditions, but allows the expression of religious tradition, celebrates those things, and allows people to express their religiosity without influencing either domestic or foreign policy, seems to be, to me at least, might work more effectively. And the other thing I would like to very quickly mention, that whether Islam is compatible with secularism itself, looking at the Islamic history and Islamic texts, because that's what we do, I focus on Islamic texts such as Quran and the Hadith and try to delve into the authentic sources. And after talking to so many people, I do think Islam is not only open to secularism, but I think in a way it promotes secularism. That's my experience with it, because one of the things that we look is the first four caliphs of the Islamic tradition, and if you look at the Quran and the Hadith, there is no political model. Many of those models have been developed so much later. And if you look at the Medina contract between the Prophet and the Muslims and non-Muslims of the city of Medina, which actually Rousseau briefly notes in his social contract, had many of these ideas of, I think it, in a modern world, it could be adopted. And also, it is important for me, I think, to mention that Islamic law, which is understood as Sharia, is not, as many have come to claim, is not a constant. And there are many Islams, as many Muslims, but one of the things, if you look at the Quran itself, that Islamic law is very different in nature to the Western law because it has options. So it has hudud, which means the borders, and within that you have different options that you can choose from. But the hudud is you should not exceed that. So, and there's this has been used in Islamic tradition, as was mentioned in the morning, for good and bad, but I think it does allow for an Islam, for an Islamic society to have a secular society. Oh. Very, very good. Thank you.
And thank you to Professors Aisha, Feruz, and Catherine. There's nothing left to me to say. So I, as a journalist, will try to do a, you know, simple reporting. Today on Hurriyet newspaper, which is a daily paper in Turkey, it's, you know, one of the leading papers and mostly circulated, its chief editor, Ertuğrul Özkök, was talking about the, you know, debate that we debate in Turkey about secularism, which started recently on, you know, I'll have to take you to 2 weeks prior to the news in Turkey, which Nürnberg, you know, prominent sociology or anthropology, which one? Sociology professor had given this extensive interview to another paper. And she said in this interview that when she moved to a new apartment, and help me to remember the story right, in Istanbul, that she felt hesitant to call friends and relatives to hold a praying in her house. And the belief is that usually, you know, what Muslims do believe is that when you move to a new house, you hold a praying, and it's just, you know, probably wishing that it brings good luck or a blessing to your new place. But she said that she was hesitant because she didn't know how her neighbors are going to accept it. And so she was not able to hold the praying. Did I get that story right? Okay. And so this created a lot of debate among the columnists. And it turned out to be that the chief editor of Hurriyet had picked up this debate, and he said he never heard of such a thing, that no Muslim in Turkey was hesitant to hold a praying in her house. And so the Islamist media reacted to it, but not only the Islamist media, the other columnists in Liberal and other papers also had different views. And today he writes and actually asks the question to further pursue this debate. And the question is, who or which leader was that oppressed religion in Turkey? And he basically lists the former presidents and prime ministers in Turkey. His first one is Süleyman Demirel, who happened to be both the prime minister and president of Turkey for several times, and he served for 10 years and 10 months. And then Adnan Menderes, 10 years and 5 days. And then Turgut Özal, 5 years and 11 months. Bülent Ecevit, 5 years and 7 months. Tansu Çiller, 2 years and 9 months. And I can continue the list, but I hope you got what the point is. And then obviously we have Abdullah Gül, who is now the current president of Turkey, but who basically served for 4 months in the beginning of the Justice and Development Party's government in November 2002, and he served for 4 months. Now, Recep Tayyip Erdogan is the current prime minister. He is leading for a second term, and he served as the prime minister of Turkey for 5 years and 10 months. And so this is the list. So if we have these, the question he is basically asking, who oppressed religion in Turkey? And the question is, actually, I'm also looking forward to the debate in tomorrow's papers, who's going to lead on this and how they're going to interpret it. But this is the live debate that we have. And then on a second, you know, column today, again, which appeared on Hurriyet newspaper, which was from Ayşe Arman, who's a very popular, you know, columnist in Turkey, and she is also good in terms of breaking this, you know, into the social dynamics. And she is reporting, actually, you know, rewriting an email that's been sent to her. And I'm just, you know, translating these things because I really changed everything that I was thinking to say as I listened to you. So bear with me as I'm trying to make it, you know, I hope I'll get, you know, able to make a coherent argument here. But Ayşe Arman, you know, publishes this email as it is without giving the full name, full last name of the reader, but the first name is out there, and it is Nazlı, who's 27 years old and a student at Koç University. Now, we have the new custom in Turkey. I mean, private museums here has been here for, I don't know how many years, decades probably, but it's a new fashion in Turkey. And Koç and Sabancı has their museums probably in less than a decade, probably 5 to 6 years. And so this student, Nazlı, goes to Sabancı Museum. And it's at a wonderful location. But, you know, the thing that is that this is a museum. And she goes to the Abidindino exhibit. And while, you know, she, you know, surfs through the, you know, pictures and whatnot, she also likes to go to the restroom, and that's what she does. So when she goes to the restroom, she sees these two women who are head covered, who have these long, you know, coats and, you know, dressed in the Islamic style, but taking their ablutions. And so she tries to wash her hand, but I don't know whether anyone knows how to take an ablution in the Muslim style, that you not only wash your hands and face and not, but you also wash your feet. And so they were washing their feet. And so the, you know, the drops of the water was coming to her hand, I mean, to Nazlı's hand. And she just, you know, didn't feel comfortable with it. And she's saying, she's basically asking this question to Ayşe Arman. Okay. If this is how we are going to give in, if this is how the Islamist wants to pursue, and if this is the way how they understand, you know, to take their role in the society, should we be accepting this kind of behavior? And I think, you know, this is also a question for the professors, to distinguish what part of it is culture and what part of it is religion. And what is it that we need to really focus on? And then I will take you to one of my articles, which I had written on May 1st, 2007. And this was the time when the Turkish Prime Minister, after a long debate and after, you know, really building up the expectation that he's going to, you know, seek the presidency, he decided not to. And so then, you know, we started, I don't know, I'm not sure who really wanted to push for Abdullah Gül's presidency, but his name came up. And at the time, Nuray Mert, another prominent columnist at Radikal Daily and a strong supporter of allowing women to wear headscarves in governmental institutions, she said this. I'm quoting it right now from my column. I feel embarrassed to say what I will be saying now because of my stand on the headscarf issue, but because the president's wife will be wearing a headscarf, the AKP has decided to create a crisis. The war of symbols has moved to a higher level. So as Cem Özdemir, Professor Ross, as you mentioned, when he was telling that whenever we are talking about Turkish candidacy in the EU, we constantly talk about, you know, the headscarf issue. Actually, that's the only thing that we also talk in Turkey. I don't know if there's any other debate existing. So and impulsively, on April 27th, we have the most a highly advanced coup in Turkey, the IKU as we name it. And here the military wrote, again I'm quoting, arguments over secularism are becoming a focus during the presidential election process, and the Turkish armed forces are following the situation with concern. The written statement read, it must not be forgotten that the armed forces are the determined defenders of secularism. But basically, the argument that was put forward was the headscarf of the First Lady. And that is something that we need to focus on. What does the headscarf mean, and how did the Republic of Turkey dealt with the issue? I mean, it's not about Justice and Development Party. It's not about the Welfare Party, because the military says, as it says not only on this one, but at each time the Republic's basic principles are challenged, that the reactionaries has been there from day one. And yes, they have been. Basically, Atatürk principles changes this, you know, old traditions and tries to bring, let me actually, you know, have one more thing. Where is it? To challenge the concept, and I will bring, hold on 1 second. I know that I have it with me. Okay. I'm sure, you know, our Turkish scholars will know, but the Kubilay incident is a very important one for anyone to understand the challenge to secularism, especially from the military perspective. And for that reason, on December 24th of every year, we have a written statement released by the Turkish Chief of Staff. There is a reason for that. So I just, you know, want to read to you this year's statement. And I'm going to not read the whole of it, but just, you know, I'll start, you know, with it. The statement explains itself. The statement will explain itself. To the honorable members of the Turkish Armed Forces, it writes, today marks the 77th anniversary of the brutal martyrdom of Lieutenant Kubilay, along with two of our watchguards, Hasan and Şevki, by a group of maddened reactionaries observing the secular nature of the Turkish Republic as the main obstacle before their anachronistic ambitions, attempting to change the form of our republic. So as you requested, and maybe that's a needed, you know, information, the incident took place in Menemen. And it was a moment this gentleman, Lieutenant Kubilay, is a very young officer in the Turkish military, who is, the rest of the statement will talk about, you know, him as a self-sacrificing youngster bound by heart to Atatürk's principles and revolutions, I'm quoting from the text, have taken their exceptional place in our republic's history, proving their steadfast determination, what it means to die for their beliefs rather than giving concessions. And what was, he didn't have the gun, but he was facing the Islamists. And he was beheaded, although we say that the Turkish Islam is not violent. This had taken place in Turkey, in Menemen, at the central Anatolia, and they put his head on a stick and tore around the whole Menemen city. So this is something that we need to remember. If the extreme goes to the extreme, we have seen what happens. And but my, you know, point is, again, I will have to, you know, continue quoting from the Turkish Chief of Staff's statement here. Our great leader, which is Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, has expressed that it is impossible to continue our existence being stuck in the past with outdated ideas that have been discarded by time. Instead, left us a thinking system that is distant from dogmas, yet in guidance of science and wisdom. So this is the challenge, but has the Turkish Republic or the leaders that Ertuğrul Özkök has quoted or, you know, cited in his column today been loyal to Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's vision? This is not about Recep Tayyip Erdogan. This is not about Justice and Development Party. This is not about Welfare Party. This is not about the Islamists. The threat that we have is actually coming from the so-called liberals and seculars of Turkey, because they have not been loyal to the vision that's been put in front of them. If you want to challenge something, the better thing that you should do is to understand what the threat is. and then deal with that threat. That's why science and wisdom has been put in front of us. And so I will go back again to my column on May 1st, 2007, and I'll quote Beyza Abidjan, who is my, you know, professor when I, you know, read about Islam, and especially when it comes to women. But this is not about, you know, the women, and she has a recent book about place of women in Islam, and that's a fantastic one. If there is anyone who can help her, I would appreciate it to be translated to English, because I am sure that it's going to contribute a lot to the debate here in the United States as well. So here what Beyza Abidjan talks about, find a place. Okay. Atatürk is perceived as the reason, but in fact most of that policy. Religion was, okay, here's the point that she's saying. She recalled the first headscarf incident at Ankara University in 1960s. I think that's the crucial point that we also, you know, have to underline. That a student attended courses wearing a headscarf and her professor asked her to leave the classroom. The next day, tens of girls came to school wearing headscarves. Then, Mrs. Vegan said, CHP, Republican People's Party, who claims to be Atatürk's party, and, you know, I personally, you know, wish that they dropped that, you know, definition, while explaining themselves, brought busloads of people to campus to support the covered girl. They never understood that unless religion is part of the solution, modernized and made relatable to the people, winning the battle against radicalism is impossible. And the failure of the Republic of Turkey have actually come from within inside because of the dismissal of any positive view of contemporary Islam. And although we have a state ministry in charge of religious affairs, I, you know, have strong doubts about the substance of the knowledge that has been produced through that ministry. So I wouldn't say that, you know, in a first Muslim nation who chose secularism and democracy as its destiny, not to have a ministry as such, but I would question the role of that ministry, whether it was up to its challenges. And today, even today, when you visit the ministry's website, you see the definition of how a Muslim woman should be covered, and there is no other way. But I know, like Beyza Abidjan, who is not like me as a journalist, but who is speaking by knowledge, like, you know, professors Aisha, Feruz, and Catherine, that, you know, when she reads and studies the thing, it's not the text that calls for headscarf, but it's the interpretation. So in 2007, in the century of 21st, I bet, and I'll just, you know, wrap up very quickly, I bet we can do better if we can follow the path of Atatürk, and that is science and wisdom. But on the other hand, I'll have to wrap, I know, but just, you know, with a, you know, quick note, although we do not like in Turkey Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, quite much, I have to give him some credit. First, he had a fantastic, you know, pick, you know, Carla Bruni is a, you know, fascinating woman, and they do really look very well together. And but the second thing is, I think when he was here a year ago, he had given a speech which, you know, I wouldn't agree with him when he compared the Turkish candidacy to what had taken place in the French banlieues. Because I believe even, you know, the people who, you know, rebelled and have done such a thing, they, you know, attach themselves to, you know, having difficulty because of their religion, but because of other stuff. But I have to give credit to President Sarkozy that he's asking for time before accepting Turkey as a European Union member, that a European Islam be emerged. And this is a fact, because Turkey failed to create that contemporary Islam, which is the main principle of its founding father. And this is what Nicolas Sarkozy is actually saying. And so if, you know, I would say for, you know, the secular and liberal Turks, to understand what was the real legacy put in front of them, I wish they were not to take Mr. Sarkozy against them, but to ally with him. Because we are not talking about a Turkish candidacy today, but we are talking about a Turkish candidacy in 10, 15 years. And you know what? I think that, you know, time is needed. Because I, as a woman, would not feel secure if Turkey becomes a member of the EU today. We need to have certain things fixed in the way how we challenge the real challenges that is not, you know, there is no time to talk about those. Thank you. So, I have the enviable task of wrapping up and summarizing the many fantastic points made today. And Professor Ross, I'm sorry, but I've got you beat. I don't think I know as much as you do about Turkey, but I do know something about international law, and I do know quite a bit about the debates that have been referenced here today about identity, how rights can accommodate identity, the subtext of fundamentalism and multiculturalism, those kind of accommodation spectrums. I know something about that, so hopefully I'll draw together these comments and say something kind of useful. So first, what I was struck by was everyone starting with Islamic identity and how those narratives compete among speakers and within the text of what the speakers had to say, and particularly I'm appreciative for Professor Ross's the orientation of her remarks, which was Turkish immigrants in Europe, as reflecting some of the tensions that are happening within Turkey and the identity issues there. And so the competing narratives I thought were very interesting were this competition between the threat to Islamic identity outside of Turkey within a European context for immigrants who are seeking accommodation of their views, and the threat of Islamic identity within Turkey, and the need, as you so eloquently pointed out at the end, to make more contemporary Islam. And so I'm not going to bring any of my own thoughts on that to bear, but I will point that out to suggest that these narratives get reiterated and flipped back and forth as we talk about the issue of secularism and Islamic identity. And it's interesting because there's been much written about that in terms of a U.S. overreaction to Islamic identity and the European underreaction to Islamic identity. And I think we gave short shrift to how popular that discourse is now in Europe about the soft multiculturalism that will inevitably destroy Europe. And, you know, that those are very palpable debates, and those narratives, as we've discussed today, keep getting turned around and reversed in ways that aren't particularly helpful, because what I think is happening is that we're just creating a very short spectrum between the secular and the fundamentalist. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about today is how do you fill out that spectrum? How do you make it a little bit more complex than you're either a fundamentalist or you're a secularist? So those narratives compete, and then the other theme that I really picked up on today were what you do with those competing narratives. And it seemed that the default position for most of our speakers has been law. Well, that makes sense. We're at a law school. This is a legal conference. But not so much has been said about what exactly on this panel, how the frameworks that are in place are actually going to accommodate that. And some of that was discussed in terms of German reaction and some of the more nationalistic approaches to that accommodation. But I'd like to suggest that within the thoughts expressed today, there were other competing narratives expressed. And that was this, that if we're going to talk about law and legislating for restrictions on religious expression or for rights to religious expression, there has to be more critical thought invested in how those things are going to sit together. Particularly with the examples given here, the right to education that was talked about in particular, the particular European context, the right to religious expression that has been talked about in the kind of Human Rights Watch-esque context. So the let's integrate
Turkey into Europe, the people that we have who are trying to make lives for themselves in Europe and who are part of that soft multiculturalism that is can be misused at certain points, but is prevalent and is a concern, at least in popular press and among the identity theorist circles, versus the rights to pluralism, the right to stable self-government, as reflected in decisions from the European Court of Human Rights. So let's integrate Europe into Turkey. There's an interesting dualism here that I think goes beyond just let's pass more laws or let's invoke international standards. That's something that's worth thinking about, and I think something that the speakers here today really touched upon. And what I thought was interesting in kind of preparing for this panel was, and in terms of my own background, how those narratives clash within a court structure or in thinking about what international language would come to play. It goes without saying, and I think we are kind of, we are running out of time. I think it goes without saying that there is a kind of schizophrenia within the decisions of the European Court of Human Rights about what religion expression means and who gets it. And there's not going to be a lot of headway made on this issue until we can sit down and think about those issues in a more holistic fashion. And I'm hurrying now, but I'd also like to point out that I often read that another solution is invoking international standards, but again, we need to draw into this debate the very real criticism of those standards, which is well known to everyone in this room, that they're very one-dimensional. I mean, I recently read the CEDAW report in 2003 for Turkey, just to get a sense of kind of literature out there, which doesn't mention culture at all. Like, there is no discussion of headscarves and of expression and religious accommodation or lack thereof. There's something wrong with invoking the wisdom of international documents if they don't actually speak to the complexities of the problem. And I'll end by saying that that comment leads to what's been touched on as well, which is gender is the good example of that. And headscarves is a popular topic to debate because it does capture a lot of these ideas and a lot of these tensions. So with that, I'll end. Thank you very much.
As always, there was not enough time and too much to say, but we do want to spend a little time with discussion and questions. So I believe there's a mic somewhere. There was at one point. Questions. Yes, maybe come up here. Questions or comments? And we'll go for about 5 to 8 minutes.
Thank you. I wish I could be as witty as the panelists here, but it seems to me that it's my kismet today to talk about the political issues. Unfortunately, that constitutes the unpleasant aspects of the whole thing, maybe. But the point is that, including Atatürk's government, Atatürk's time, Muslims were never suppressed in Turkey. And that includes the other successive governments in Turkey. This is a fact. And secondly, there is no problem of religious identity in Islam. It is conjured up by the imperialist interests of the West. Now, there is this thing. The postmodernism, which is a shallow ideology of capitalism, in trying to cover up the sins of capitalism, they foster this kind of, you know, multiple or multiplicity, you know, dividing everything in the societies. Now, in Turkey, and maybe in other areas that our friend has researched, there are dingies, the ones who exploit Islam, and there are the dindar ones, the devout Muslims. As a result of which, this is the problem. It is not the problem that the people are suffering because they cannot declare their or pronounce their religious identity. But it is the fraud in Islam, Islamists, and the true, you know, devout Muslims. That is why now today's present government in Turkey made a deal with the European Union And I'm just trying to tell them, make me look good in my efforts in joining to the European Union. In return, you'll get your concessions from Turkey, political concessions. There is a deal, and it's a serious deal, and they perpetuate this game. At the expense of Turkey, the Atatürk's era, the Atatürk's reforms, revolutions, and laicism is going to be hampered, impaired by the promises of European Union to this government, to this Turkish, present Turkish government.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Comments from the panelists? Would you like to comment on that? Rachel?
There was no question.
Well, I think, you know, maybe I can say a few words if no one is, you know, answering it. I think your point is, you know, well taken. This is a, also one of the active debates that we do have in Turkey. But then the question is, who will do better? I mean, do we have an alternative? And this is why, you know, I think we also have to face the realities. We have to face the facts. It's not about, well, you know, we have to do better.
I just want to briefly say one of the things that I've wanted to mention in my comments, which tangentially relates to your comment, is that it's not about this idea that we could just talk about culture and not talk about coercion and not talk about those ideas is crazy, and that's I guess what I was trying to get at with talking about thickening up the dialogue, and I guess that what you had to say didn't strike me as that process of making more thick. It kind of seemed to me to be addressing those ideas, but not really getting underneath how we work with them.
We have another question. Here we go.
My question goes to Professor Ahmad. You raised the issue this morning of this social aspiration on the part of the Turkish society towards a more patriarchal, return to a more patriarchal society that would, in fact, threaten the tradition of Kemalist secularism and even more so laicism. I can't help but draw a parallel with Iran, with the situation in Iran, where I think it's exactly the opposite. I mean, the Iranian revolution was came after, I mean, based on a structure of the clergy that resembles a lot to the Rome of Caesar Borgia, it's in fact an elite, an aristocratic clergy elite that caused this revolution, in fact it's a secularization of religion for the purpose of instituting and then maintaining a totalitarian regime. Whereas we see in Iranian society now some social aspiration to at least secularism, maybe laicism. Would you share my hope with regard to the Iranian society?
Well, I really don't have much idea about what's going on in Iranian society. There must be people who are much better qualified, but this whole question of what I raised this morning about going away from a modernity society back to patriarchalism, you can see around the world. You can see it in the United States on a very small scale, but you see it very strongly in a country like India. Mm-hmm. Which is predominantly Hindu, but you've got a movement which really wants to undo what you might call Nehru's reforms. He couldn't do such a thorough job as Mustafa Kemal because of the conjuncture that he lived in. But he, for instance, passed a constitution which, in law, abolished caste. But caste is alive and well and becoming stronger. So I can't really tell you much of anything about Iran, but Iran, you must remember, these Ayatollahs may be men of religion, but they also have a social base. They come out of society. They belong to a certain class in Iranian society, which was in conflict with the Shah's ruling class. And that's what they've overturned. and now they have power. And this is what you're having in Turkey. This is a new class. I mean, Anatolian tigers, as they're called. People who founded an organization known as Musyad, claiming to be independent but Islamic. They were quite open about this. So this is a cultural struggle, but does that sort of answer your question?
If I may respond to you quickly, recently, just in the end of November, we took a Muslim delegation to Iran, and we met with three Grand Ayatollahs, various religious leaders, secular university professors, in the sense that they believe in secularism, and many students, and some non-governmental organizations, such as human rights organizations. And it was a very important part of the debate of the role of religion in government. And this was also raised by the three Grand Ayatollahs, and these were not ordinary Ayatollahs. One was the chief prosecutor, one was the chief judge during the Khomeini time. And they all raised questions regarding the relationship between state and religion. I'm not saying they were secularists in any way, but they were, even them were opening the question of how much role should religion have in the state. And many of the people were critical of the religion, the role religion have played in Iran. So that, to me, told that when religion and politics merge and become an autocratic system, an alternative and resistance movement is eventually will come. So we have to always constantly negotiate the relationship between religion and society.
I think we have time for one more question. I saw Professor Kola. One more question that comes from as a reaction from some of the presentations here, in particular Catherine, Aizen, and Rachel. And my question was, you seem to be somehow oriented towards an open view of being having the possibility to incorporate Islamic principle in a liberal state, even though your examples seem to be backfiring a little bit. Because law or society or education system seem to be too narrow to incorporate the multiplicities of views. And the, so I had the impression that there were lots of losers in your presentations, but I would like to figure out who are the winners, if there are some, and in the education context, in the international law context, in the peace resolution context, are there any losers of that political, any winners for that political position that you are advocating in this debate?
If I can respond, I don't know so much about winners and losers, but if I'd had an hour rather than the 15 minutes I stretched to 25, I don't think that there is a role in the schools. And in fact, I think that the Germans need to confront the fact that when they wrote their constitution 50 years ago, they had Protestants and Catholics and a couple of surviving Jews. And they never contemplated that there would be a range of other religions being taught in the schools, and I don't think the religion belongs in the school. I don't think the problem is with identifying a body that all the parents feel comfortable with, but rather trying to turn over to independent operators a function of the state. And if values are about religion and not more general ethical philosophical questions, then they shouldn't be in schools. So that would be the answer there. So maybe the loser is the structure of the German constitution.
Very quickly, I will just mention that I don't think I was trying to say that Islamic principles should be within the liberal society. But what I was reacting to a certain extent at this thinking that dominated in certain groups in Turkey, that religion as a phase, like the mythic phase, that will eventually be wiped out and religion has no role in society, and that people will eventually reach a rational secular thing and we will all be free of religion.
Who said that?
Comte August.
No, I mean in Turkey.
There were a lot of people that I know have been following those sort of...
Never heard such a
thing. No,
never.
And on that note, we will have to close.
I'm just referring to some of the people who, not officially, I'm not talking about the government, but there is sort of, pardon me? Maybe I am, but the idea that somehow religion should be wiped out of social system is to me a problem, but I do come to appreciate the U.S. system of secularism, and that is creates a more open dialogue about secularism and religion in a way that is more constructive in my understanding.
Okay. Paddy Day is going to...
You have a short comment?
Well, let me tell you my experience with the growing up in Turkey as a Muslim. I was 4 years old. My mother took me to Madrasa. The language I never spoke, I never understood. And I was brainwashed 4 years in Arabic. But it was a stick. I couldn't repeat it. With the Mullah, what he told me, I used to get stick. Never loved the God, fear of the God I grew up. Here's the newspaper on Sunday. It says Islam, one of the mankind, numbers 1.3 million around the world. With majority communities, not only in Cairo, Baghdad, Istanbul, Jakarta, Tehran, but also in London, Paris, Berlin, New York, Washington. Yet, most Americans know very little about the Muslims and also the rest of the people. One thing to do is, if you're going to read to find out the Muslim, you got to read the translation of the Quran. Let me give you a couple of verses. A couple months ago in Istanbul, the Hoja Mullah scratched the verses from Quran on the mosque. He said, do not make friends from Jew and Christians. And then also there's no equality in the Islam. You have to read all this. That's all my experience. I'm not a Muslim anymore.
Well, thank you. I wanted to really thank Susan and the panelists for giving us their time and their ideas. I mean, these are strongly held views. And this is the forum this is what we are doing here. Have a freedom to express how we feel about these things and not necessarily, and have an exchange of ideas. And maybe some of us will change our minds, or maybe something else would come up. I think, but one thing that was very clear to me when I visited Turkey, and the reason for this conference, which is confirmed here, is that there's an urgency to the situation, which I think, not in Turkey necessarily, but in the world at large, and the urgency needs to be addressed. And I hope it doesn't end just with conversation, but with us moving forward to have a better vision of things and a better understanding. Sometimes it's difficult because we say words, but they mean very different things for each of us. And, of course, our life experiences, like this gentleman was just talking about, inform us, our individual life experiences and what we have gone through. I want to thank Susan. We have small gifts for each of the panelists here. They probably have the insignia of the Washington. There's some more behind the partition. I want to invite you all. We have a reception. We have wine to unwind. I know it's not very Islamic, but anyway, we have... What else do we have? We have some hors d'oeuvres and cocktails. They're all being served in room 600 because we figured you're tired of being in this room. And what's the directions to get to room 600? Down the hall. Yeah, down the hall, and if you go next to the elevators, just turn right. Turn right, and then turn left. In room 600, cocktails. Would love to meet each and every one of you. Thank you.